Hi everyone, I'm Flick.
And I'm Natalie.
And we are both European privacy specialists from Phil Fisher, and we are going to be delivering the bite-sized legal update to you today. Natalie, what are we talking about?
Today we're going to be talking about the case of SRB and EDPS, which is the case that's caused a bit of a stir online around the concept of anonymisation.
And the genesis of this is I posted a LinkedIn post about it and it kind of went a little bit viral. So we wanted to sort of tackle some of the comments that we got and also just chat through the case because it's an interesting one.
Okay, Flick, tell us what the case is about.
Cool. Okay, so this is a decision that came through the General Court, which is a court of the CJEU. It came about in last week of April. It involves a European institution called the Single Resolution Board. We won't get into the heady details of what they do, but essentially they had been soliciting comments about a bankruptcy resolution that they were trying to pass against a Spanish bank. They needed to get comments from the shareholders and creditors of that bank. So they spun up an online form and collected the comments through that form. And importantly, when they were sort of processing those comments, they replaced the name of the shareholders with a randomly generated 33-digit alphanumeric code. Essentially, they key coded that data and then shared that key coded data with their third party consultancy firm who was helping them work through this whole process. So that consultancy firm just had the key coded data, but the shareholders and creditors had complained to the European Data Protection Supervisor. They were unhappy because they felt the data had been shared with this consultancy firm and they hadn't been told about it. So they felt that was a breach of the transparency obligations in the privacy laws that the SRB was subject to. So the whole kind of case really hinged on whether or not the data that had been shared with that consultancy firm, whether or not that was personal data or not. And the European Data Protection Supervisor had initially decided against SRB. They had said the data transmitted to that firm should be treated as pseudonymised data, not anonymised, on the basis that SRB held that additional information required to decode the data and re-identify those data subjects. That was sent for appeal. The SRB appealed the decision, and so it was pushed up to the General Court and they overturned that decision. So Natalie, over to you. Give us a bit of a flavour of some of the things the General Court said in overturning that decision.
Absolutely. So we've got a situation where the data in the hands of the consultancy firm looks to be potentially anonymous. That's the argument that SRB puts forward. And the EDPS had said, just to recap on what Flick mentions there, that the mere possibility that the data could be decoded using the data that SRB had was enough to consider it potentially as being personal data. So what did the General Court say? Well, they relied heavily on previous case law, and we'll get into the sort of controversies and the way we view that in a moment. But the crux of what the General Court said was you need to examine whether the data is identifiable in the hands of the recipient of the data, in this case, the consultancy firm itself. So what means reasonably likely does the consultancy firm have to identify individuals from the data set that they have? Now, this is where I think that the previous case law is particularly relevant and we need to be careful to distinguish some factual elements of it, because in this case, the consultancy firm had no legal means to get hold of the data set that SRB had that would allow it to unlock the identities of the individuals who'd made these comments. Now, we can talk a little bit about Breyer, which is the previous case law that we've just been referring to, because in that case, and that you may recall is the case that talks about dynamic IP addresses potentially being personal data, the means reasonably likely to and the legal ability of the parties involved to re-identify the data felt like quite a different factual pattern. And Flick, do we want to maybe pause there and dive in a little bit as to why we think this case is, or perhaps actually on second review, is not distinguishable from Breyer, which I think is where we've gotten a lot of the comments online on your LinkedIn post, which people have been a bit more frustrated with, because on the one hand, when we first examined this case, this felt like a bit of a win. It felt like something almost new. And then when we've looked at it a little bit further, perhaps it's not so new, but just a helpful clarification that as privacy practitioners, we can potentially leverage.
Yeah. So, and just really good point to raise. So the Breyer case is a 2016 European court decision. And essentially, as Natalie said, the courts, Europe's highest court, said that a dynamic IP address should be deemed personal data, because essentially the information that could be, you know, used to re-identify or link it back to an individual was in the hands, or is usually in the hands, of an ISP. So the fact that you could kind of, a website operator can file a criminal complaint in the event of something like a copyright infringement, and then they would essentially be able to obtain the name behind the IP address from the ISP, the telecommunications provider. Meant that because they had a legal means in that case of being able to route that IP address back to the individual, that we couldn't say that that IP address was anonymous. So there was a clear means of, there was some means of being able to re-identify the individual from the data. But as Natalie said, we've got quite a different fact pattern here. And actually what was interesting about this case is that general courts leaned on the reasoning in the Breyer case, because the Breyer case was very clear that you have to consider the data recipient's perspective. And you also have to consider, when you're thinking about that possibility of being able to re-identify the individual, what both technical means there are and legal means are available to do that. And in this case, the courts felt that there was a solid argument that SRB had, that there was both no legal means and no technical means by which the consultancy firm could re-identify the individuals, because all they had was key-coded data. So it doesn't really distinguish the Breyer case. In our view, if you look at it more carefully, it's kind of applying the analysis and saying, look, the fact pattern's quite different in Breyer, but the analysis remains good behind it, in that we have to look at what means are reasonably available, both from a technical and legal perspective. And in this case, there were no means by which that consultancy firm could kind of get hold of that data. And one of the things that the court did slightly skirt around, which makes it a slightly weaker judgment in my view, is that they didn't really consider properly the question of whether or not those comments that were mapped to the key coded data should be treated as personal data. SRB had sought to make arguments that the information in those comments really was related to a particular resolution, that a banking resolution that was happening, so it didn't reflect opinions or information about the specific shareholders or creditors. It was really a factual reflection of whether or not they agreed with this resolution or not. And so they had tried to argue that it literally, those comments contained factual and legal information. It was independent of the person or their personal qualities and unrelated to any of their private life. And so we shouldn't treat the comments as personal data, particularly when they've been key coded, so there's no name mapped to them. Now, the courts didn't really go in to consider those specific arguments. And instead, they kind of said, well, actually, the EDPS hadn't properly examined the contents of those contents, and that's why we think they couldn't come to the conclusion that it was personal data or not. They hadn't looked into it or not. So they didn't really get into those arguments. So I do think there remains a bit of a question there about, whether or not comments data should be treated as, personal opinions of individuals and therefore personal data. We're really looking at that having to involve a very case-by-case analysis. And that really roots us back to the value, I guess, of this case, which is we need to take a very relative approach to determining whether information is personal data or not. So in that sense, incredibly helpful. But I think it did skirt around some of the details of that analysis because of the way, I guess, the courts have felt the EDPS are kind of mishandled reviewing some of the information and therefore they felt they couldn't back up some of their analysis because they haven't properly looked, for example, at the contents of the comments.
And Flick, do you think it's fair to say that in terms of what we can take away from this, because like I mentioned earlier, when we first read it, it felt like we were getting something that was tangible that we could use to help explain situations where personal data that felt, you know, looks and feels anonymous on the one hand could actually be treated as such. Because I think up until this point, as practitioners, we've always been a little bit careful to call something anonymous when there was a glimmer of prospect of re-identification, even if the fact pattern was such that that seemed pretty fanciful. Now we have this case that says we really do need to put ourselves in the shoes of the data recipient and think about what is feasible. And actually, we have a case here where the EDPS had failed to do that and the court has said not good enough. Does it also give us a green light to say that there is a situation where we could treat the data as anonymous, or does it just say you need to examine it closely? My concern is it does more the latter than the former, but can we really use this in the way we hoped?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's going to have, for that reason, limited utility, because it's really just reflecting principles that we've seen and know and have had to work with for a long time, which is that we need to do a case by case analysis, that examines the type of data that we're looking at, the possibility of re-identification from a technical perspective. And that's something that really needs not just lawyers to look at. It needs, you know, engineers, data scientists to really dig into whether or not we think there's a risk of re-identification considering all the data sets available. But it certainly gives us a little bit more of a practical interpretation of some of the case law that we've had to date, and sort of shows that the Breyer case, when you apply a different fact pattern, can lead to a slightly different conclusion, which I think is helpful. So it probably doesn't move the needle as much as people would hope, but it certainly shows that there is the possibility for different outcomes if the fact pattern supports it. So we've still got to do that analysis. We've still got to really think about that risk of re-identification. It just shows it's not always a slam dunk. The EDPBS said, and it's a terrible thing to say, isn't it, quickly, the EDPS had too quickly applied a conservative approach to their analysis. They'd just chucked principles. Oh, you know, if you've got one piece of the puzzle in the hands of another party, then that instantly means we can't treat it as anonymous data. Whereas what this case is again saying, and as I keep flagging, it's not, that's too simplistic an analysis, and we really do need to dig into, from the recipient's perspective and taking into account everything available to them, whether we think there is a genuine risk of re-identification.
I was going to say, I think before we started recording today, we were looking at the dates of the Working Party 29 guidance on anonymisation, which is now, I think, 7 years, maybe a little bit more old. And of course, the Breyer case is not new either. There's a lot of technology out there that didn't exist 7 years ago that can maybe more effectively anonymize data. I wonder whether this case, alongside new technologies, I think we're long overdue for more fresh guidance on this, but perhaps gives something more tangible that we can examine as practitioners to try and distinguish between data that is anonymous in the hands of the recipient and data which is merely pseudonymized. So from that perspective, I feel like we've at least got something now to point to make the argument for a more than, like you say, simplistic view and analysis of what anonymization really means.
Yeah, absolutely. I think most practitioners and engineers hate that 2014 anonymization guidance because it basically set an incredibly high bar for anonymization, almost suggesting the regulators don't believe anonymization is possible. You know, that this sort of test of it effectively must be impossible to re-identify the data. If we get any case which reveals or suggests that it is actually possible to anonymize data, taking into account the particular facts, that's always, as I think, as I kind of mentioned in my LinkedIn post, a glimmer of hope that anonymization is possible.
Okay, great. Well, thanks, Flick, for summarizing that. We hope that helps you digest it and gives you some thoughts on the outcome of that case. And yeah, well, hopefully we'll be back soon with some more.
Yeah, watch this space. More bite-sized chunks to come.